So, I made a mistake in how I set up this call because I created it there in Zoom. You have two options, or at least the plan that we have has two options. One is to create a regular meeting, and the other is to create a webinar. And the difference being that a webinar has panelists and attendees, and attendees don't get on live video until they're promoted. Whereas a meeting is simply anybody who shows up is automatically on the video. So I made a mistake, and people may be coming in as attendees who will need to be promoted to panelists. So just a note, a technical note there. Hello, everybody. I don't hear you all either, so I think probably there's also an auto mute kind of functionality. There you are.
Yes. You can hear us now?
And clear.
Great, thanks.
At least you.
Good evening.
TJ, a bit volume's a bit low again.
That low again? Let's try. How's that?
I think I know what you mean for Christmas. Like to give it a few minutes anyway, because there might be a couple of other people joining us, and I want to stay attentive. How is everyone?
Good.
Good.
Haven't read all of Sloterdijk, but read the prologue.
Okay. How about you, John and TJ? Have you read any of the
I started it today. I got up to, I think, not up to the Parmenides section. So that's I got up to page 70.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
No, I got up to anthropic climate.
Did you read that part, Access?
Yes. And if I had known that I was going to get the entire point of bubbles in 5 pages there, I might have saved myself some reading time.
Well, that gives me something to be motivated by.
Yeah, it's a very
Wait, what pages was that? You read past the what was required today, right?
Starts on page 135 of my translation.
Okay, great.
Well, required is a strong word. We vacillated, I think, and we've been a bit ambivalent
Well, usually
about science.
I'm overly ambitious and read ahead, but I decided not to do that, so I'm a little bit behind. I'm going to be a tortoise this time.
Well, I think that's fine. I in an email I sent out yesterday suggested that if folks who might want to join us, didn't even begin reading, that they could join us and we could incorporate them into the dialogue somehow. So, but maybe nobody will. I'll give it another minute. A person named Heather Fester, a friend, also signed up, and I don't know if she's going to attend tonight or not. But she lives locally, or used to, and is a poet, just completed a degree or a program at Naropa University in the poetics program there. Before that had been a student of rhetoric.
Wow.
And then I think her thesis or her PhD on rhetoric. She's also a Gebser and has presented at one of the Gebser conferences. And so it
Oh,
would be
she did?
wonderful if she joined us because
Recently? Last one?
the 2016.
Oh.
So I would love it if she joined us because I think she'd add a really interesting perspective to this. And she's been kind of in a place last we connected of exploring sort of post-modern philosophies, alternative integral type philosophies, and looking for, I guess, maybe theoretical diversity or meta-theoretical diversity,
Now,
perhaps.
I have a book I could suggest, which was triggered by this reading this chapter. He talks about Atlas a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I just read this, Prometheus and Atlas, and this guy's Jason Reza Giorgiani. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
He's very intense. He's Jeffrey Kripal has... I read this book because Jeffrey Kripal liked it. And because he's talking about the superhuman potential. So mm-hmm. he's very in that Aurobindo futurist kind of actualizing this sort of hidden potential in humanity. He also talks about the paranormal and also about Heidegger.
Mm.
His idea is that Atlas and Prometheus are the most important figures for our time, that we need to drop Jesus. Been through that. We've done that. We need to now start getting very Promethean. So he has a definite, and he comes from an Iranian culture. So he comes from Zarathustra, talks a lot about Nietzsche as well. And I know you're a fan of Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's sort of maybe one of those alternative people to, you know, he's also, I understand he's on the, he's the alternate right. He's a real right winger.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that makes him a very odd character.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the monstrous, I don't think anybody else is going to join us, so why don't we begin? And I thought I'd begin with an anecdote, which may or may not go anywhere in particular, but that's part of what I wanted to investigate and part of what I hope we could, you know, put our minds together around. So I went to Denver yesterday and met up with Caroline. We had a meeting, essentially a business type meeting, talking about Cosmos Cooperative and working on essentially a modeling process around what that could look like. We were calling it the viable baby. And so she's written a bunch of material that she's looking forward to sharing and to inviting others into a dialogic process in developing that model. So we did that meeting, and I won't go into it, but when we left, we happened to be in Denver, and we were at the Denver Public Library, which is just near the Civic Center, and it's just near a large park called Civic Center Park, and it's kind of the, you know, the heart of Denver in terms of its governance and in terms of just the crossing of populations. So the politicians, the homeless folks, tourists, etc. And I had been alerted by someone that there was a exhibition of a set of sculptures by the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei in the Civic Center Park. And it's the Chinese zodiac, 12 animals of the Chinese zodiac in large sculptures, kind of, you know, centered around one edge of the park. And so I thought, well, I'm there. Let me go see it. So after I said bye to Caroline and her friend Draft, I moseyed to the park. And as I was walking, I noticed, oh, look, we do have another participant. And it's Duggins.
Hey.
Hi, Doug. Welcome. I was just telling a story. And you've come just at the poignant moment. Because as I was walking through the park to go see Ai Weiwei's exhibition, I noticed a sphere just kind of off to the side. And it was a globe, very much like the globes that are depicted in the book, Globes. And as I approached it to investigate it, I noticed that there was a man in the middle of the sphere. And this man actually had four faces. So it was kind of like a double Janus. And they were facing the four, you know, directions longitudinally, horizontally on the sphere. And as I looked at the plaque, I saw that it was a sculpture of Christopher Columbus. And so Christopher Columbus is inside of this globe, which, like, you know, we're going to read about or we have read about, is this perfect orb, which in the globalized world that we're in now, we are essentially living within. And so I looked at it, I took a few pictures and noted, you know, the serendipity of the encounter, and then went and looked at Ai Weiwei's pictures or sculptures, which were much more central in the in the spatial distribution of this park. They were the highlight. And the globe was actually kind of off to the side, I noticed. And then I caught the bus home, and I read the introduction on the way home. And things started to click as to, well, a number of things have been clicking as I've been reading, but the kind of what I think I learned, or what I noted at least from the experience, was that what I think Sloterdijk is talking about is not just an idea. It's something that we're actually living in some sense. And what he means by ontology, and how ontology relates to being in the world, being with others, and being in a life or an ensouled space, is kind of what is at stake in this reading. And this figure of the golden orb, the golden ball that is kicked around from thinker to thinker, and the matter of concern that is, like, that's, I think, part of what began to connect for me and to make the reading meaningful, that there is a matter of concern. It's not just an idea. It's not just that globe that the philosophers have at their feet. We have to think our way into it. And that's, I think, I've kind of ended up, or kind of where I'm at in this moment as we're converging to have this conversation. So I wanted to share that just to start, because I've been a little bit anxious about what are we going to do with this? You know, it's a lot of reading. I have these two books and they're huge. They're heavy. You know, I carried this thing like Atlas with me in my backpack. All the way to Denver and back. And
you feel like you're pushing the rock up the mountain, right?
That's Sisyphus, yeah.
So I kind of want to get our minds around, like, what is the matter of concern? Like, why are we doing this, really? And how does it relate, like, to our spheres of concern? And I don't have the answer to that exactly. I have, I think, some ideas, but the ideas are a kind of jumble and a swirl. And I don't know how to fixate them without connecting it to your ideas. And so I'm very curious about how this will go. And I'm open to being surprised.
I was thinking, it's interesting that you were talking about a globe, but an exhibition, because yesterday I went to a art launch for one of my friends, but it was at a collective art launch, and one of the other artists was presenting bronze globes. So globes, again, they're sort of runic globes with sort of symbols on them, but in solid bronze, which is, they're such a weighty, you know, they're small globes. They're about this big, but they're still, they weigh a ton. So you could switch out Sloterdijk's volumes for one of these bronze globes.
It's interesting how you start seeing them everywhere, and how the kind of power of suggestion primes the mind to notice what you otherwise might completely overlook. And
sorry to go on. This idea of ontology is really interesting, because I've been working in my research in ontological issues for a number of years, and I tended to think of it as this idea of a theory of the nature of things, or a theory about what things are? So the idea of what things are being, and then what is being. So the nature of being as being what an ontology is. But then I encountered this colleague of mine, and she was using the word in a totally different way. And she's a musician, and at first I didn't understand the way she was talking about it, but then we had a discussion about it, and because she was using ontology as being, you have an ontology for, each of us has an ontology for our lives. So it's an ontology at the individualized level rather than this sort of global theory about the nature of things. But she said, that's still ontology. Ontology is the nature of things as much in their individuality as in their generality, if you like. So that there's this whole approach to ontology that is very general, but there's another approach to ontology. And I think you see this a little bit in Sloterdijk, where he slides between the general and the individual to some extent. So there's this idea of, we each have an ontology. It's very interesting.
Well, we each have an ontology. I don't think I do. Mine's quite evasive, elusive. I think I have, I'm sort of, this talk about being always drives me crazy because I'm very aware of becoming. But I find the whole topic of being to be very boring. I don't want to be. I want to become. Of course, I know there's a deep relationship and but I'm very attracted to becoming. I like Whitehead and process philosophy and, you know, Aurobindo and Bergson, that on the move kind of spirit. Motivates me. And I get from, so I know a lot of you guys have followed Heidegger, and I just find that snooze time. I just can't get into it. But anyway, that's my thing. And I've always like, ontology, what the hell is everyone talking about? I'm fascinated by epistemology. I think there are different types, different kinds of philosophy that interests you. And definitely I'm very drawn to epistemological questions and how do you know this? So I know there's deep relationships between ontology and epistemology. You can't have one without the other, as Gregory Bateson used to say. But anyway, I'm wondering, my big question as I started to approach this, and what I like the most about Sloterdijk are his titles. The chapters, the titles really get my attention. Reminds me of Wallace Stevens in that way. You know, those wonderful poetic titles, you know, The Emperor of Ice Cream, you know, those kinds of things. And I wondered what the monstrous is here. The monstrous, he talks about geometry. That really sort of, the project of the geometry and the monstrous. In the little bit that I've read, he makes mention of the monstrous in the Dionysian theater, sort of contrasting that with the serenity of the gentleman philosophers, you know, from the gates of the city, sort of in that grove, you know, outside of the city walls, and it's that sort of serene circle. He does a lovely scene. He creates a wonderful setting, I think. He's looking at that mosaic, that famous mosaic, the Torre Annunziata. So I really like that about him, how he'll dwell on an art object and he'll just sort of free associate with it for a while and then he'll move on to something else. Sort of, I always feel like he's like a guide in a museum and sort of gives you a docent in a museum, sort of brings out an artifact and knows everything in the world about it. So I think that's very fascinating. To me, he's sort of, you may disagree with me, TJ, but I feel like he's more of like a cultural analyst than like a philosopher who's presenting arguments. You know, I've never found an argument yet in what I've read. Or if there's one there, it's so subtle that it's over my head, which is what I'm used to. When I go to a philosopher, I'm studying the argument. And I can't find one here. He's very elusive. And I think he's definitely into the mythological and the magical as well. But I think his attitude is very detached and definitely an observer. He seems to favor the observer mode. I don't see him as a Nietzschean kind of get down into the, embody the warrior or anything. So, and I think he has a very, he's a storyteller, sort of a magician type. I mentioned that earlier in the previous reading that I thought he had a strong magician kind of energy or a wizard energy. But the downside, you know, the dark side of the magician is deception, self-deception. Mm-hmm. You can create wonderful stories that go nowhere except they keep people entertained. And I think that's his strength. And strangely enough, I think that's one of his weaknesses. I mean, I should talk. I would love to tell stories that go nowhere. But, you know, but actually, when I do tell stories or an anecdote, I usually do have a point, maybe a subtle point or even a stupid point. But there's a point to it. And I sometimes don't know what the point to his anecdotes are. So that's just my response.
I've actually got the opposite impression what I read in Globes. And it's just, you know, my reading of it. This is refreshingly direct compared to Bubbles.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
I don't know, call it an argument or not. He's slapping philosophy down left and right. had a couple of really good quotes that I just really liked from it. The learned Scola sworn to a communitary enthusiasms. It will in future be held together by an anachronistic turn of phrase, problem awareness that removes them from all other human groups. Like these guys are, you know, they have to come away from the concerns of the city. They have to come out of life pretty much to sit and talk about this object at their feet. And he goes on, he makes a couple of other observations that, you know, philosophy has just kind of distanced itself from real life concerns in order to create this symbol of the one and encompass everything. And I think that you were talking about the monstrous, that's just an attempt to mentally encompass this, the unencompassable.
And they're focused on being. I mean, that's a big topic for these.
Yeah, they're focused on trying to comprehend it, and Sloterdijk is saying that, you know, they're more or less successful with that.
Hey, I want to see if Duggins could say hi. I have some thoughts, but he hasn't. This is his first time on a call on this book, and I'm curious where he's got with it and how he's approaching it since we've all gone around. Hey, Doug.
Hello. So it's nice to put a couple more faces to the words I've seen written on Infinite Conversation. So hello, Jeffrey and TJ.
Hey, Doug.
How you doing?
All right. I do not actually have this book. So I came as kind of an outsider, kind of wanting to jump in at some point. I feel like I might possibly be able to start with this second book as opposed to start at the beginning. We'll see what happens. But no, I'm just here to kind of listen. And I like the comment you made, Jeffrey, about the different take of ontology. I'm not too familiar with philosophy up until this last year. And ontology has kind of been my go-to philosophy in general. I started with Paul Tillich, who's a theologian, but he's also quite a philosopher once you get down to it, which he goes into the ontology of quite a bit of things. This week I had to present a book called Love, Power, and Justice, which been to the your friend noticed, Jeffrey, it's everyone has their own ontology to a certain extent. There's the kind of academic term, and then there's the being of each individual. I'm just here hanging out.
So, Doug, I'm curious, like, what would be, you're almost kind of representing this outside monstrous perspective that Sloterdijk, is pointing to with this idea of the sphere and what's beyond the conceived sphere. But also it's useful to have an observer in a way, because, we're in something that you're not yet. And we're having a conversation, which might make no sense. Like, we might just really have a certain kind of, we might be kind of talking intellectual gibberish. And someone with, that isn't absorbed into those thought forms could potentially, give a reflection, like, can you clarify that? Or, how does that relate to something else that I'm understand natively outside of this particular discourse? So I just want to, invite you to participate, even if you don't feel like you've read, by helping to, like, reflect back, what we might not be seeing. Because I actually want to get to something in the conversation. Like, I don't want to just be, like, entertaining ourselves. And I had this experience reading Globes, particularly it came with the introduction, because after the prologue, I had this, I felt a bit, what was it? I wrote about this on the forum. I felt intrigued, but a little bit disappointed in a way, because it seemed that what Sloterdijk was setting up was this kind of elitist, distant, objectivizing type of scenario, and I noticed that he started this second book much in the same, on the same note as he started the first book. If you recall, the beginning of Bubbles is a meditation on the saying at the entrance to Plato's Academy, and the way that Sloterdijk tells it, like, let no one enter here who's not a geometer. And so there's this idea of a special society, a special group of people who understand something about the nature of reality that nobody else does. Right. And this recurs now in at the beginning of Globes, because we're presented with the scenario through the mosaic that John, you referenced, the Annunciata,
Torre Annunciata.
which is depicting a classical scene involving seven philosophers, seven sages. They're all bearded men who, like you said, are outside of the city, outside of the market, and who've gathered together to have what Sloterdijk describes as a serious conversation, a very serious conversation about this object that's before them, and they're pointing to with their rods, and they're discussing. And he describes this scene, curiously, I thought, but then it made sense, as a Pentecostal religious kind of scene. It's not just that they're, just having a leisurely debate, but there's a sense of transfixation by what they've touched into with this notion of there being a measurable shape that they could locate themselves within. And that, more than that, that described what I think is the point and the matter of concern, which I got very clearly then in the introduction, and that's this sense of the whole or the all, the everything, the the nameless in a certain sense, like what that is. When we talk about being and the relation between thinking and being and that golden ball that's being kind of thrown from philosopher to philosopher, and the inscription at the beginning of the book quoting Nietzsche about the golden ball, how Zarathustra, how I'd love to see you play with the golden ball. So what is that golden ball? Well, that's a figure, but it's has this manifestation in these philosophers' thoughts and in the history of Western metaphysics as this one all-encompassing orb, which now in the modern and postmodern age has collapsed into an infinitude of self-referential microspheres. This is the foam that we're getting to, and this is kind of like describing taking the subway or taking the bus or going anywhere in the world. Everybody's in their own world, essentially. Everybody has their own ontology and
their own cell phone.
Yeah, right. And their own reality and their own virtual all-encompassing reality is where we're going with this, right? So what I see Sloterdijk doing here is telling a story, but also I think trying to think into, and I hate to just kind of lapse into Heideggerian jargon or something like that, but to think into what was lost from that sense of there being a center that's not your personal self, and how could that be recovered in a certain way? This is where I think this could go. How could that be recovered in a way that's not totalizing in the mode of Western metaphysics, but at the same time isn't totally atomizing in the mode of the foam of postmodernity? And I don't know, like, we're not there yet. Like, this volume of Sloterdijk says is what he calls it a mausoleum, John. You'll get to that. And he's parading forth or exhibiting a kind of record of expired or collapsed spheres, which is painting the picture of what comes now, of where we're at, where we are now, which he calls the monstrous, because the monstrous is the space beyond the conceived sphere. And it's the inability, the absolute inability to construct a perfect sphere that contains everything. So it's kind of it could be disturbing, and I think there's a mad. He talks about the madness too, like the centripetal madness.
There is a
by the way.
There is a reference to the monstrous that comes to mind too, because when so I'm trying to think who the philosopher. It was Riemann or Poincaré, when they came out with the idea that you can have parallel lines
converge
that meet. Yeah. That was considered to be monstrous by the mathematicians of the time. And then it became the defining geometry for Einsteinian physics and space-time. And so it became, the monstrous became the de facto reality in which we live. And so I'm sure Sloterdijk is aware of that reference in behind. I suspect so, anyway.
I'm curious about that too, Jeffrey. It violated some axiom in Euclid.
It was the fifth axiom of Euclid, yep, which said that parallel lines can't meet.
Right, and so you have that all those alternative geometries, which now makes Euclid look really very static, to say the least. And I think that's where a lot of the static being to be a product of this kind of Euclidean geometry, which they all knew very well, as did our founding fathers. You know, they based the Constitution, all men are created equal. It's like a Euclidean axiom. But I'm just curious about this almost obsession with the orb and the globe. Because, I understand that, but we've been also talking about to topology and other kinds of topological figures, like the Möbius strip and the lemniscate and the torus, and the one I love is the Klein bottle. And it just seems to me that they have a different kind of quality than the non-orientable nature of the globe. And there's something else. You said something else, Marco, about, you know, everyone being in their own little bubble, and everyone has their own reality. And I'm remembering something that Kerry Weld said about everyone has their own reality, and then there's consensus reality. But no one lives in the consensus reality. But we all pretty much know what it is. I mean, we can engage with the consensus reality. You know, when we, politics seems to be very involved in that, and so does our education and medicine. You know, there's a consensus reality. But like she said, that's not where any of us live. So I think that's what's lost. That's what I think people are losing a grip on, is a consensus. So we're all getting more and more just self-referential, and we find others who, you know, will share some of their attention with us, but most of the attention they share with us is not a very high quality. It's pretty fragmented. And so I think it's troubling. And so my interest is in the intersubjective, which is not the same thing as a consensus reality. It's when two or more are gathered together. And then what happens? And that I think is very difficult to measure or to quantify in a way that would render it, give it a consensus that we could all point to, something objective that we measured together and we can say that's the real. So anyway, that's what I'm perplexed by and curious about, is that intersubjectivity and how we can model, like we've been doing recently and other forums, how we can model each other's map of time. And strangely enough, even though we found out that we have different maps of time, we can understand another person's map and actually be curious about it. But I think that's a very subtle kind of formal interviewing. It's a qualitative research, and it's really focusing on the intersubjective, but you have to have that right balance. And I find myself very frustrated by this text because it's so tantalizing, and I will read it, large sections of the previous book, and I've just started this one, and I agree, TJ, it's a lot more it's a lot easier to follow. It seems a lot less elusive, the little bit that I've read. But I can't remember exactly where I wanted to go with this, so you'll have to pardon me. And I hope some of that made sense, but I found myself getting really frustrated because I would read large sections of it, and it's very conceptual, which is okay. Philosophers are doing that. but I never get a definition. Not one. And he doesn't necessarily use, so he uses concepts in a, they get fuzzier and fuzzier as he goes along. So I sort of long for those definitions and some sort of rigorous argument.
You'll never get it in Sloterdijk, I think.
Yeah. So what's my purpose here? You know, well, if I have to give that up, then I'm just going to say, oh, this is just sort of a nice chatty guy, you know, in a museum, you know, seems to know a lot about the stuff, and I could certainly learn from him and be charmed by him. I think he's extremely entertaining. But you know, I would love to, like, could you, what exactly do you mean by that?
it will be interesting to have this conversation though, after everyone's gotten to read that section, Anthropic Climate, because like he went back and pulled in all the things that I thought that I was kind of teasing out from his introduction in Bubbles and all the like excursus one and excursus four in Bubbles that just kind of made a little bit of sense because it did tie in with limits of transference and that strong relationship. And he just kind of explained it really well in that last section. And page 128, and he was talking about post-structuralist philosophy and how now instead of seeking the essence of things, which is what these philosophers have been doing for the past 2,000 years, it became about chasing the event and not letting the container and not letting the structure keep you from an understanding of the event. And sort of a way that Tim Ingold would also say, the event is going on, and you capture that. And Sloterdijk says, that and other forms of philosophical thought are, quote, all forms of naivete that one loves because their naivete is that of philosophy itself, as if philosophy has kind of not caught the orb and just kind of missed the whole thing of being. And he goes on in that page to say he's after, again, quote, an ontology of the finite, inchoate, monstrous world, and this means creating an equilibrium between conservative and explosive elements. One could also call them psychological and technological interests, both in their respective radicalisms, which really struck me as a kind of integral thing to do. And what we were talking about the other day, about taking the philosophical, theological, and taking the technological phases and just kind of bringing that together. He's seeking something that will encompass that in replacing the one great orb of mystery, what the philosophers were chasing for the past, thousands of years.
So there was something I noticed too in reading this, obviously the prologue, which is the part that I read, is that he kind of, you were saying, John, there is a continuity in the way that he's dealing with things. It's not that different from Bubbles in some ways, but there is a kind of a, okay, guys, we've done Bubbles. Now we're going to set the Bubbles aside. And the other thing is about Bubbles is it was all about spheres that were containing things. Right. But we start off globes with looking at the globe from outside it, not from inside it. And I think there's a clear effort on his part to move away from this englobing idea of spheres that one had from Bubbles to something that is more exploded, more this distance, more, because Bubbles was all about not distance. It was about having all this stuff up front in your face. But now we're at something which is the éclaté. I don't know how to say that in English.
Mashed together. Splat, I believe. Éclat. But it's not just looking at it like he makes the contrast between Atlas holding the thing and looking at it from the outside and Parmenides, who's looking at the globe from, or trying to get at it from the inside, but it's supposed to be some central point that illuminates the whole thing. Jeffrey froze on me here.
Okay.
I see him moving.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, there it is. He's looking at it from both inside and outside, the global sphere.
That's helpful. Oh, and thank you for elaborating on that a little bit, because that gives me something to look forward to.
I'm just getting more of a sense that there's an actual point to this one, and I'm still, Doug, if you don't read Bubbles, Doug, just start with Anthropic Climate and Globes and then go back and then just read Globes.
See, I'm starting to pick up on that, I suppose, but yeah, that was a good picture there, Jeff. So I like that image.
So in the first book, we were inside the bubble and in the mother's womb, and we spent a lot of time in there, in the prenatal psychology. And now we're outside looking at the globe, and we have a different kind of relationship to it. Is that what you're saying in this new... in this.
Well, that's what I got from the opening section, that it has a different feel to it that way.
Yeah.
So it's more about political philosophy.
Right. Yeah. We're moving from individuals to society.
And how it's organized and
how
it's been historicized.
Yeah. Right. But Sloterdijk, I think one of his points is that he's trying to say that there's an understanding of, well, not even an understanding, but it's an experience of intimacy that happens in the microsphere with the bubble. I mean, you don't have any control over the womb you happen to emerge in, and that just kind of frames your being. And I think he's saying that there's also that kind of communal thing going on a larger scale. As you're putting societies together, you're also kind of finding yourself in an atmosphere before you start making decisions about what the shape of your culture is going to look like.
Moreover, I would say that he's saying that it's necessary to have some form of what he calls quote unquote air conditioning. And we can talk about why the air is kind of an important metaphor. It's important to have that so that you can have some form of solidarity, some form of witness in a population that's that large. And like part of what I think we're examining here in Globes is what that looks like at the level of an empire, like what that looks like when the globe is a totalizing being that's aiming for some perfect enclosure that is trying to distance the monstrous as much as possible, because every empire has
keep the barbarians out.
Exactly. But I think that it was important for him to start with bubbles, because he wants to, and he says this much, to understand that intimate sphere as more primordial. Like that when it comes down to what matters to us, it's shaped in those primary dyads. And then from there we transfer it, you know, to these larger spaces, these larger spheres that, you know, are rounded off in their various ways to, you know, as immunological membranes or functions. And he ties us to being. Now, I want to talk a bit about being, because I have a particular, I may read some things in this book pretty strongly, and it's because, and I know that this is not the only dimension of his dialogue here, but he's, I think, really in a conversation with Heidegger and Nietzsche and Plato, and that. That conversation like captured my kind of fascination or my mind when I was in college. So the question of being, there was a time in my life when I was, you know, 20 something old man, where that question that was very, it was mind blowing kind of, and I almost had a moment kind of like he describes, where you get a sense of what that really means, like the being of beings, or you may not be able to articulate it well. You know, are probably just going to sound like a complete fool trying to talk about it, you know, like in a college dorm room smoking pot or whatever. You know, it can easily lend itself to such conversations. At the same time, there was something that, much like, again, like he describes as a Pentecostal or a kind of religious experience. I felt that. And I was enamored of Heidegger and Nietzsche, and I spent many hours with my face buried in their books. I read Being and Time twice. I lost friendships and alienated my family, you know, while exploring these thoughts. And so I finally got the sense here in the introduction specifically that's what he's talking about. Like he's having that conversation that I was like initiated into through this event in my life. And so the religious aspect of it, which he's very, you know, cool about, but it's there, and he's flat, you know, giving glimpses into it, perhaps. And he's always ambiguous. He's always going to take both sides. He's going to praise the sphere in a certain way, but he also is basically doing a post-mortem on the sphere. So he's not advocating it. Mm-hmm. So then this sense that the like, what's the center? What's your real kind of matter of concern? Where is that? Is it yourself as a personal ego? Is it your culture, your faith group, your institution, your country? Or is it God? And if it's God, how do you understand that relationship? And is that God an enclosed God? Or is that God an infinite God whose center is everywhere and circumference is nowhere? And if that's the case, then is your God a monstrous God, right? Like, there. And if you're going to be in a relationship with that God, or that meaning of being, or however you phrase it, then what does that require of you? Because the spheres that he's talking about each have their kind of requirements to sustain them. Like, there has to be something you do in a intimate relationship, in a village, in a nation. What sustains the relationship between a self and the center of of being as they see it? And that's kind of where I think, you know, you get to this eccentricity and epicentricity. And once people start thinking about that, then they don't really quite fit easily, like in lesser geometries. And so that sense of alienation from, or that sense of the philosopher is kind of set aside, or that elitism, there's something to that. And it's also a trap in another way. And I think Sloterdijk is kind of pointing at that, but he's ambiguous about it too. And I don't know exactly where I stand. I'm sort of feeling it out. And does that lead anywhere?
I think we're all, as the argument goes forward, we'll see exactly what he's trying to point out. But I mean, for these philosophers to go, they have to kind of leave a sphere to go out and talk about a bigger sphere, don't they?
Yeah.
You know,
maybe leave the orb shape, maybe begin, traveling in Mobius strips and Klein bottles and
possibly. I was going to ask you, as I haven't read Heidegger, what do you think is the conversation he's having with Heidegger?
It's between being and it's between time and space, and the relationship between, or maybe how to put this, but in a sense, like, what's more primary or what's more necessary to think, time or space? Sloterdijk wants to think space. He wants to foreground an experience of beingness, and Heidegger wanted to interpret being in terms of finitude and time. So Heidegger emphasized the being toward death, the being in the world. And there is, I think, a sense in this conversation between them that is a dead end, that the descending or the infinitizing current toward the world has to open up into a more, and this even is kind of where Heidegger goes in his later thinking, the so-called turn, into more of a sort of spacious openness, I would say. That seems to be what Sloterdijk is opening up, is some kind of sense of spacious openness in the way that we relate to being, because that I mean, that comes up in the quote that you read for us about the post-structuralists and this way that they're still doing philosophy, because that philosophy is, even if they're deconstructing spatial structures, they're still doing that almost driven by an impulse to further and further atomize being, or further and further kind of get to a smaller and smaller thing. And what I'm getting in Sloterdijk is the sense that that process sort of plays itself out.
And the logical end of the logic.
Yes, and then it's like time, and maybe this is where like the non-Euclidean geometries would be useful. Like time almost like flips or inverts back into a spacious awareness, because there isn't the anxiety as much anymore. There's another theme that Heidegger, you know, elaborated upon. He wrote an essay called What is Metaphysics, where he talks about this fundamental existential mood of dread, this sense, he asks, what does dread disclose? What's disclosed in that attunement, that mood, something that Sloterdijk talks about in Air Conditioning? And that attunement, that mood discloses, he says, nothing. Nothing. Mm. And so the nothing is the, and this is not how Heidegger would put it, but kind of the driver of metaphysics. That's the monstrous. Like that's the shadow of the metaphysical project. And it's sort of like this, the unreachable center of it around which everything turns.
Right. Okay.
But that mood of anxiety and of focus on finitude, I guess. Maybe you know, plays itself out, I guess, is all, you know, you could say. I mean, you eventually want to relax into being in some way. You eventually want to relax.
I think you can relax into being if you're well fed. You know where your next meal's going to come from. I mean, and I was, the neoliberal rhetoric was fine with me until the recession in 2008. And the business I worked for, they went under. And then there I was in my mid-50s without a job. And I was unemployed for 3 years. You know, I had to take the shittiest kind of work for $8 an hour. And I'm talking about lifting heavy boxes and going up and down 5 flights of stairs and walking through rat shit. So it really wakes you up, because I hadn't had any, you know, I'd done pretty well. I could always, function. And I could also afford to, I had a lot of leisure. But I was up against it. I did recover from it to some extent, not psychologically, but I did recover financially to some extent. And went through a period of relative prosperity. But, you know, that's sort of behind me now. And I have a new, you know, dealing with becoming an elder and what happens next. And I don't have any faith in this neoliberal, the report on the jobs and things are getting better. And this is the best of all possible worlds. You're hearing that stuff again. And I'm just wondering, what planet are these people on? Even if I'm not in a terrible situation, I've been in a terrible situation, and I identified strongly with those who were still in very terrible situations. You know, that's why this stuff about being bores me out of my mind. It just seems like something with people who have a lot of time on their hands to reflect upon, which most of these philosophers did. They had a lot of time on their hands.
Almost all of them.
Yeah, someone else is making, you know, making a cup of coffee for them or whatever.
Is there any sense of urgency within?
I have a great sense of urgency. Yeah.
I understand that with you, but with Sloterdijk, is there any sense of urgency?
I'm not getting it.
That seems to be where maybe the spatial metaphor is kind of reaching out towards, versus the time. Being in time kind of gives you an anxiety once you examine your life. So is Sloterdijk, with these spatial metaphors, the spheres at this point, is he kind of taking us out of even what we can imagine, like with time, I can relate to it as a human, as we did with our time models, but with the spatial models, like we're always going to be contained in this body. So to jump out of that and see it from outside, maybe this book too, it kind of pointing at the sphere or whatnot. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Like, is he an urgent, it seemed like Heidegger was more urgent. Like, I've got to get this out. But from the tone I'm picking up for Sloterdijk, it seems like there's no urgency. There's no, not necessarily no meaning behind it, or just kind of like Ed might have mentioned, just sort of he's throwing stuff all about and whatever. I don't care. I don't give a F. But
yeah. Heidegger's writing, I mean, like I said, I haven't read him, but I know he's writing in the 1930s in Germany. And Sloterdijk is writing, I believe this stuff is between the end of the Cold War and before 9/11, correct? In these books, I know they've been translated recently, but I think they're like from that 99 or 2000 or right around the turn.
This is published in 2014, but it was written earlier.
Yeah, that's what I meant. The translation, yeah. I know, is recent.
I know the first book was in 1999. I think this came out after 9/11, but maybe I'm wrong.
I'll have to look it up.
In which case, he doesn't know much about 9/11.
Right, right. But I'm saying that, you know, definitely we're talking about a different sense of urgency.
Right.
You know, right. and just in the times that they're writing.
And I'm very aware of, like, Occupy and Wall Street. I mean, I marched with them. I saw the Bloomberg paramilitary formations beating up people. And I saw this is a very raw nerve. And I think it did go global for a while. And now we're seeing Brexit and we're seeing Trump. And we've had this very interesting discussion on the Trumpocalypse.
Backlash, yeah.
And where are we now? And that's why I was drawn to this book, because I thought maybe he has some models that would be of use. So I'm all for going back and looking at Plato, but I don't think he's a very good model for what's happening right now. You know, the philosopher kings and all that, and that totalitarian regimes, which, you know, and throwing out the poets and all of that stuff. I mean, Plato doesn't have a great track record, I think. And I don't think Heidegger does either. When he was the head of all the graduate schools in Germany, you know, the rector, he did everything the Nazis wanted him to do. His own teacher, Husserl, could not use the library. I mean, this is one of the rules that Heidegger made, even though he had Jewish friends. And I think, who's that, the famous philosopher?
Hannah Arendt, yeah.
He was dating him at the time. He was a married man, but they were having an affair. So he was a very weird, his performance was not spectacular. Although some people are very attracted to his writing, but I think a lot of people have let him off the hook. So I'm looking for something else. And I'm hoping that, you know, studying the political philosophy and the history of it could be very illuminating if we have our eyes on the prize, you know. And I don't know what's going to replace this neoliberal fantasy that I think Obama's administration the last year was just a mess. And he sort of set this up, I think. And the Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and the very intense period for all of us, I think. But I'm sort of wanting to, like, well, what's going to happen next? I'm looking for the rebirth, in other words, you know, the phoenix rising. I hope we don't go into further chaos, because I don't think we're going to recover very quickly from that if we do.
And anyway, Sloterdijk has a bad reputation as well for some of these, not quite Nazism, but, well, although he has been accused of that. Almost. So he has, the jury's still out for me about the bottom of Sloterdijk's thinking. You know, I think in some sense we're waiting to see how things will evolve with him.
Have you heard anything?
I'm convinced that he's quite in the same wavelength as I am, for instance, or you are, for instance. We are. I'm not convinced of it yet, but And I do think, I wanted to come back to what you were saying, Johnny, about the becoming. And Sloterdijk doesn't talk a lot about becoming. He did a little bit in Bubbles. But it was all focused on the dyad thing. But it's more about being right now. And a lot of the later stuff, I think, is also focusing on being. I noticed, TJ, you mentioned he debunks all the philosophers, but he actually names Deleuze as one of those he's not debunking.
That's true, yeah. He had Nietzsche, I think, and Foucault and
Deleuze. Yeah, and Deleuze was one of the ones that he sort of said, we give him a pass.
Right.
But Whitehead wasn't in the list.
Right.
He's not into process philosophy much, is he? I haven't heard him quote any.
I don't think so, but I do think that the process philosophy is an important component to what, I mean, it certainly speaks to me, and it's more in Deleuze also, who has a lot of that in his writing, and not very much in Sloterdijk. And I understand the argument about Heidegger and time and Sloterdijk and space, but I worry that if we stay only in space, we're going to miss the boat on the larger issues somehow. That if you just focus on space and relations in space, I don't know, I think you miss the broader structures of the universe, mm-hmm. which are spatial temporal structures, not only spatial or only temporal. And it comes back to the Klein bottle, which is a space-time kind of structure. Yeah. Rather
process than, over structure.
Yeah, so I worry about these things. But I'm still giving him the benefit of the doubt whilst we read forward on it.
Right.
But interestingly, go ahead, John.
No, I was just agreeing with Jeffrey there. Yeah. I mean, you read him for what he's good at and what his focus on what his strengths are. And, you know, I can't blame him for not addressing issues that are personally relevant to me. I may need to go to somebody else for that. But for what he does offer, you know, very erudite, real smart, very sensitive to beauty, maybe a kind of static kind of version of beauty. He's not into rock and roll. He's very much into chamber music. But I share a lot of those enthusiasms with him so I can enjoy his... you know, the polished surface that he presents. But I wonder who's having to clean the toilet while he's so charming. You know, there's something someone said, this is a little vulgar. The guy who wrote Dahlgren, he's a science fiction writer.
Samuel Delaney.
He said there's two kinds of people in the world. He says there's a little bit of grunge on the toilet bowl behind, right in the middle of it. He said there are people who know about that grungy area on the toilet bowl and those who don't. And I know a lot of the people, because I've worked for them, the 1% here in Manhattan, they don't know anything about anything. You know, they just snap their fingers and it's there for them. I mean, I've been a member of the servant class and they paid me very well and they were extremely nice people, by the way. But I think he's coming from that kind of, you know, ring the bell and someone's going to come and get something for him. So it's a very different way of operating. And so I understand why he may not feel a tremendous amount of urgency that other people do. But I don't think he seems to imply that that these people who are disenfranchised and in earn these struggles are not aware of the whole. Whereas those who have the leisure time to reflect on it seem to be have that opportunity. And I think he's wrong about that. I think there are people who are disenfranchised and dispossessed who are very aware of the whole and how it works.
But they're not unaware.
They know how to function. You know, a lot of these rich people, if the elevator breaks down, they don't know what to do, you know. They're going to be in real trouble unless somebody fixes the elevator and then they can get in and out and do their business. But I don't mean to be, I want to be balanced about this, so that I can appreciate, you know, that there are those with privilege and advantages that use those advantages and privileges in ways that are of service to humanity, for sure. There have been plenty of people who've had privilege who did good things with that privilege. So I'm hoping he's one of those, you know. But if he's talking about this anti-immigrant stuff, and, you know, this sort of, I don't know. I haven't followed that part of his discourse. But I've just heard that he's sort of I've said enough on this, I guess. But I guess that's where my curiosity leads me. So I'm looking for loopholes. How can we get out of this mess? And I'm optimistic that we can. If we sort of have some good models, I believe we can re-educate ourselves and recommit ourselves and move forward. And I'm looking for allies. I was hoping that he would be one of them when I started the first volume, but I sort of gave up on that halfway through. I started looking for other things to follow in his text, which I found. You know, I enjoyed the last read very much, but most of the pleasure of it was from your companionship with you guys, because you were all bringing something to the text that I often didn't notice. So maybe that will happen again here. So,
whereas I'm also seeing some of what Marco was talking about, where Sloterdijk, there's people who are unaware of how things function, and they're unaware of the whole, you know, that's a kind of a portrait of people. But then if you go back to what he said in Bubbles, these same people are not unaware of their own personal dyads and relationships and the strong communities that mean, yeah, that's all you have in the world, but you just kind of stick together in that. And just going back to the space versus time, Sloterdijk's structures might not deal with time, but he's repeated it often throughout both Bubbles and even Into Globes, how fragile these spheres really are. So kind of time sneaks back in because they're not going to be here forever. Your person, somebody's going to die and who you connected with personally in the microsphere, and these macrospheres, nations crumble. Spheres pop. You blow them out to an infinite expense where now you can't even reach him anymore, and the bubble goes away, and you're constantly trying to find the next thing that's going to contain it. You know, so I think I don't think it. He probably doesn't emphasize time, but I don't think he throws out time altogether.
Let's pause for a moment because Heather Fester joined us, and I don't know if she doesn't have her video or mic on, but if she, oh, now she does. So I wanted to give you the chance to introduce yourself. We've been kind of going for about an hour and 10 minutes or so. And I talked a little bit about you because I saw that you had signed up and I thought you might be joining us. So I kind of talked you up. And
lies.
So, hi, and hi. Welcome. Thank you. Let me introduce you. We have Jeffrey. I don't know the order that they're all in or whether you see the names, but there's Jeffrey, John, TJ, Doug, and you know me, and you're Heather. So,
yeah, thank you. I wish I could have my video on, but it's not working. So,
what brings you to Globes?
Well, I had been interested in spheres, and I'm a little worried that I'll be in over my head starting with Globes. But, you know, I'm doing the IPS reading group, and we have some Sloterdijk scheduled. So I thought,
say what IPS is?
Oh, yeah, Integral Post-Metaphysical Spirituality reading group. So I just started that as a way to find community for some reading. And since, I thought this would be a better place to do this kind of reading. And
well, we're all in over our heads. So.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Excellent. Well, just in the, I thought it started at 7, this call tonight, for some reason. I was thinking 7 o'clock Mountain Time, but I see I was wrong. So sorry about that.
That's okay. So have you picked up the book?
I can get a copy through the library by next week. Mm-hmm. So yeah, where are we at?
Well, we're just getting started with the second volume, so this is Globes, and I think TJ suggested that a few pages that kind of summarize the bubbles, the first volume, and the path to get here. And you know, I think we could. You can get the summary if you want to just you know, read along with us. Part of what I think we want to talk about too is just how we want to conduct the group and what we want to get out of the reading, how we want to support each other, what we could bring to it. Like, how could, if Sloterdijk is not necessarily like our ally, if he's not going to be there scrubbing the back of the toilet with us, but there's something, you know, we're on this path of reading these books, and you know, I'm kind of conflicted about it, actually. Still, more not conflicted might not be the right word, but I have multiple feelings about reading this, because I enjoy it a lot, actually. And I also am sensitive to and sense kind of what John's talking about, that, and Doug too has brought up, that is there an urgency to this? Is this helping? Does this is this relevant to like our moment? And interestingly, I mean, Sloterdijk is the most contemporary, you know, big thought philosopher you can probably read, you know, now, as far as somebody who's kind of stepped up on the world stage of philosophical discourse or whatever have you. And you know, he's alive now. He has thoughts on immigration. He has positions and perspectives. And in a way, we could, like, in real time, track the applicability of his thinking to real world events, and see really how what we think about those, and how those influence our own positions or perspectives. So I'd like it to, you know, I mean, the other thing too is the idea of spheres. If we're reflexive with that, then how are we enacting or embodying what Sloterdijk is writing about? When are we coming together in a one orb? What's the center of this group? What are we, or if there isn't, then what holds it together? Like, we're sort of creating a bubble in a way here. And so the fact that we're reading about it gives us an opportunity to be reflective about our own process, and to learn something that is beyond just a theoretical understanding. It's something that we could embody or practice. So I'm interested in doing that. I have a passion and love for philosophy, not because I just want to have a great picture of the world, because I want to live in it more profoundly. And so that's part of what excites me about reading this. And at the same time, as we've kind of been discussing in our forum, Heather, you know, there's like a lot of other things we all want to read. Everyone has their own interests and their own obsessions and what really turns them on. So how do those respective interests and viewpoints become part of a conversation? And so that's what I'd love for you to share more about, like, what you're really interested in. Because I know, and you know, John and TJ, they've been in dialogue, so we have a sense of each other. We've had, Volume 1 and other things. But I was telling about your poetry in Naropa and your work in rhetoric. And I just mentioned these things to give a sense for, you know, where you're coming from. But you'd be a much better person to describe yourself, obviously.
Cool. Well, I'm excited about that. Sorry to break the bubble by being the new person.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah. Well, I have to get a grasp for how bubble is being used, because that might speak to something I've been curious about a lot. And I'll have to do some catching up. That's my plan. But where do I want to go with this? I'm really interested right now in participatory spirituality. And I don't know why, it just seems to be the thing that I'm most drawn to. And it also seems relevant in a really interesting way, because it bridges that gap between being and being in the world, kind of. And I'm not a philosopher by background. That will become apparent very quickly. I'm a pretty good reader. I read in different ways. I read kind of hermeneutically. I read poetically. I read against the grain with the rhetoric, focus on ideology. But I'm not as deeply conversant as a lot of people I know with philosophy. So what else would you like me to say? You've already introduced my background.
I'm curious about something. Can you elaborate a little bit about rhetoric?
Yeah.
And why rhetoric? Because I'm very fascinated by that topic.
Cool. Yeah. Well, we just did a really cool, I should have invited Marco, a really cool salon discussion at the Integral Center in Boulder. So salons are like the integral theory and practice talks twice a month. And the topic was steel manning, which is Robert McNaughton's term for strengthening the position of the opposition so that you get it and it also eases the polarity and there's a relaxing and taking on of more perspectives. So in that, I got to talk for the first time in an integral context about rhetoric in some depth and the history of rhetoric. And I was drawn to it because I wanted to teach writing and I didn't trust myself as a writer when I was 21. So I went for the most professional degree I could. I got my PhD in rhetoric and writing.
Wow.
And, yeah, so I've been teaching.
So you're a doctor. You're Dr. Heather Fester.
That's right.
Cool.
I've been teaching higher education since 2001, which wow. Everything is rhetorical. You know, the first semester I taught, 9/11 happened, and I had to find a way as a 21-year-old to relate to 18-year-olds with some maturity about a tragedy the day it happened in the classroom. So that was, you know, it kind of set the tone for my career. And right now I'm teaching a series of essays where they're exploring 9/11. So, you know, from different perspectives, speeches and stuff. What I love most about rhetoric is that it's inherently multi-perspectival. And historically, I think this is really significant and fascinating. The fact that rhetoric was marginalized and kind of an outsider to philosophy because it did this practice and several other things that weren't respected, like rhetoricians sold their teachings and they wrote them down and that wasn't looked upon kindly and all these other things. But what they've done from the beginning is they've always said that the rhetorician is the good person skilled in speaking. So there's a sense that before you can persuade someone of anything or take any perspective, you actually have to have a grounding in moral philosophy. So that's raised interesting questions for me over time. I've really wanted to explore who gets to determine who the good person or good man at the time skilled in speaking is. Like, obviously that excludes a lot of us in the history of rhetoric. But those are some of the issues that continue to be interesting to me. And I'm going to write an article on integral rhetoric. So I'm just putting that out there. Maybe I'll be accountable if I announce it.
Could you talk about the relationship between rhetoric and poetry? Because that seems very interesting to me too.
Between rhetoric and poetry, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Connected in interesting ways.
Absolutely. So not only did Aristotle write about both, right? Or not write about so much as lecture on, but I think the thing that fascinates me most is the praxis, the way that they apply their theories about the world. And I do think they're distinct, at least in my practice with them. So rhetoric has a lot of artificiality to it. If you look at a lot of rhetoric books, they're giant lists of what is belletristic, what is aesthetically pleasing or motivating for the reader or for the listener to hear, what will influence people. And they use tropes and they have, you know, all these figures of speech that are meant to be beautiful. And yet poetry goes straight into what is beautiful and says, what do I know from here? I think anyway, it's more, for me, it's been more a process of letting go of my mind with poetry and getting into the heart or soul or self and just really learning to play again and learning to trace the outlines of my subjectivity or my relatedness. So those are some of the things I've thought about. I'd be interested to hear what you think though.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome here because we really need your help.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I think your skills will really balance a lot of the gaps that I have. And one of the pleasures I found in this particular reading circle, in this study circle, is that, you know, whatever gaps I have, I found other people can sometimes fill in those gaps for me. So it's
cool.
It's great.
Thank you.
Plato had some thoughts about rhetoricians and poets.
He sure did.
You know, I think of Sloterdijk, I want to say one more thing about this guy. And that is, he's a bit, to me, my metaphor for him, he's a speed bump. You know, I'm moving fast and all of a sudden, boom. Pick up another. So I have to slow down. And I have to confess that may be useful. I have to sort of go at his pace because he's certainly not going to go at my pace. You know? He's very, very lots of long sentences, you know, and lots of question marks. You know, he'll a whole paragraph full of questions, which he proceeds to answer none of. So I have to just sort of slow down and just deal with his tempo rhythm, which is very leisurely compared to mine. But, you know, I think that maybe there's a value in that. Maybe there's that. We've been talking about the power of now and that long now, rather than getting into those beta rhythms where everything's very fast and maybe a lot of innovation happens there, but it's in those slower rhythms where there's power. So maybe that's my bias. He's sort of bringing that to my attention. So thank you.
I also just like to say really quickly, a lot of my interventions in this circle of readers tends to call on my science expertise. But I also have another part of my life where I write novels, and we haven't talked about it at all. So having somebody whose main interests are in poetry and rhetoric, I think will help bring up the other side of this, which I think we need. It's a little bit of the air conditioning you were talking about, Marco, I think, to air out some of the discussions with some other elements, I think.
There's a new forum, Integral Poesia, which has been interesting to consider, you know, the root in poesis and the making, the honing. Hmm. So maybe that's what we can pull out a little bit with that focus.
You know, Heather, I think I should offer just like a little bit of background to set context, since part of this is that you're kind of coming in medias res. It's a good spot because we're also transitioning to another volume. But we did 9 conversations on bubbles, one for each chapter and the associated excursi. And it was, we had a mix of people. We had John Ebert on at first. We had a fellow named Ed Mahood on, I think, all of the calls. And he played a particular role. He was sort of the critic and the curmudgeon, self-described curmudgeon in the group, who really kind of held Sloterdijk to task in a way. And so his spirit is somewhere in the air, if you will. There, we still have the you know, he's still circulating in his feelings about the book. And in the forum, he expresses them often. And that's been useful to read against Sloterdijk, you know, as much as to surrender to whatever he has to offer, to find the value in what he's really bringing forth. Having that multiplicity, I think, is really useful. And like I was saying earlier, I'm interested in this as a reflexive experiment as well. And so we've seen too how the bubble kind of inflates and deflates and differentiates and then fuses with some other like micro bubble or what have you. And we're using that term sometimes metaphorically. I think Sloterdijk, I think there's more to it. And And like I've argued on the forum, I don't think that he's necessarily positing the sphere as the correct shape for reality. But what I think he's doing and is showing how constitutive it is for our conditional reality. And so seeing that more clearly, I think for me at least, is one of the things that is that I want to explore further and kind of get to the bottom of. Like, we talk about global capital and stuff, and that's like he's describing that. He's describing the ontogenesis of a globalized capitalistic world, and also he's describing it at, tracing its ultimate demise. That's interesting too, because he's already calling the worldview, the metaphysics that underlies and forms and structures this reality, this consensus reality, as expired. And so that speed bump, John, might be that sort of death deflation that we're all like experiencing.
There's more than one speed bump, though. It's a speed
bump. Yeah, but the airbag only deploys once.
I would like to suggest that we, because we've been on about an hour and a half, and we've tended to go about 90 minutes. I'd like to open it up to discuss like how we want to do these calls, how often, kind of what speed we want to go at. We talked about it in the forum, and I want to confirm that and maybe reiterate and confirm that with the folks that are here. So maybe I'm debating whether or not to read this, but I will. Let's bring it back to the text and then talk logistics. Here's kind of what's at stake, I think, like, as far as the thinking of globalization, the study of globalization. And this is why I think it's so cool. This excites me. Like, I underline all this and write squiggly lines. He writes that globalization can only be understood by opening up to the realization that the thought figure of the orb is an ontologically and thus technologically and politically serious matter. Thinking means playing a part in the history of this seriousness. This serious history, very serious, this serious history is the history of being. Hence, being is not simply some time or other, but rather the time it takes to understand what space is, the realest of all orbs. And he goes on, the breakthrough to the concept of the actually existing orb brought the muddle of human history to its conclusion. So now he's talking about that philosopher's globe. As the epoch in which the real, lost in unclear fibers of time, still had to be recounted and ushered in post-history, the state in which space has absorbed time. All right, that might have been a little unclear. Let me keep going. The rest of the paragraph. After the stories, the simultaneous world. After the stories, the meta-narratives, etc. The simultaneous world. For those who recognized it, the orb triumphed over the line and the calm of essence over the twitchiness of becoming. Post-history, so he's talking about now, therefore, is as old as the philosophical theory of the orb. What this refers to today is the attempt to imitate on the terrestrial orb what Plato had already demonstrated in the cosmic orb, relaxation in the apocalypse of space. And the way I interpret that is that, what is the aim of globalization? Like, what is the aim of this economic system, social, economic, political, ontological, technological system? What is it trying to do? What are we trying to do through it? And if what he is saying is right, then we're trying to create a state of perfect leisure for ourselves in a perfectly secure planetary system of some kind. Like, that seems to be what he's pointing at, right? Like, that sphere, that globe that we're kind of trying to create, what Plato imagined, global techno-capitalism is trying to manifest. But there's an outside to that. And so that more than tension, like that like tectonic motion between the inside of that envisioned and that manifest or manifesting sphere and what can't be contained in it. I mean, that's kind of, I think, what's at stake in this book and the next. So anyway, I don't know if we...
And the spheres tend to collapse. So it might start off all embracing, but as it gets, it starts to exclude more and more people as it collapses inwards, you know, so...
Well, I think when we're making a huge shift, whether personally or collectively, and when you're going to the edge of your map and you don't really have a map anymore, I think you can take a leap into the unknown if you have but you need to bring a few of those motifs from the cosmology you're exiting from. Mm. So I think that maybe he could be providing a service, because I think he's very aware of like these relevant motifs that have repeated themselves throughout you know, Western history and our attempts at creating a civilization. I don't think we're quite there yet, but so that I think would be a very good orienting frame for myself to revisit, you know, Plato and Parmenides and the pre-Socratics, and which he's very good at, and the medieval world. He's very sensitive to those. He's very Eurocentric, though. I mean, he's not going to go, I think, into Eastern philosophy much, but. So I think that's just my feeling of what I believe would keep me very motivated in reading him. It's like, oh, well, maybe I can take that with me into this next phase, into this turbulent phase space I think many of us are having to deal with to various degrees. Thank you.
So what's next? It's almost the end of the year. Holidays are coming up. And it's a big book. And we've talked about trying to get through this one and the next by springtime or so. I haven't done the math on exactly how many pages that would entail.
Were we talking about Aurobindo in the spring? Is that going to be something we were going to try for?
We're talking about it.
Yeah. I'm wondering if we could do one this volume and then go to the Aurobindo and then pick up maybe the final volume of Globe, Phones,
mm-hmm.
in maybe the, what would it be, the summer?
Well, we might be tired of Sloterdijk by the time we get to the end of Globe, so that might be a good way to go.
Oh, you want to do both of them back to back?
No, I think it's too much.
But this is a big volume. I think it'll carry us through the spring. And then if you do Aurobindo in the late spring, that's another a big one too. But it's one that I'm very drawn to, because I need help with Aurobindo. He's very difficult. So that's just my feel that if we focus on this one, and I don't mind, you know, big chunks of the text and meeting a little more, I don't know, you're very good at that, setting that up, Marco. I know when we did Gebser, it was twice a week, wasn't it?
It was very intensive.
Yeah, and I think we did it in 3 months.
Yeah,
it was twice a week, yeah.
It was a lot for that amount of time. I mean, Gebser is somebody we'll have to revisit again and again.
Please. that would be good for me.
And that's kind of what I'm trying to think about, is what's a larger trajectory? And, you know, what we all have our individual readings and our individual projects, but it's good to have some things in common. But those things should be common. They should really feed into what we each want to do individually and collectively. So I like Aurobindo a lot. Part of what I want to do is read these fundamental thinkers, you know, those who are in thinking about the whole. There, Aurobindo is certainly one of them. Heather has mentioned Roy Bhaskar. Michael Schwartz brought him up as well in a couple of our previous talks.
I like Bhaskar too.
And there are a universe of possibilities of thinkers we can read. And in a way, like reading spheres, it was kind of a whim, honestly. I was attracted by the idea, that's all. I liked the idea of bubbles and thinking in those terms, and the metaphor was alluring to me. And it seems like we could read a 3-volume philosophical, it's only, 2,000 pages? But then you get into it, and I'm convinced now, which I wasn't necessarily after Bubbles, that he's a really serious thinker. And I think that he has a lot to say. I do want to ultimately read all 3 volumes. I don't need to read them consecutively. And I don't know if that's the healthiest thing. I think it would be very good to complement Sloterdijk with a variety of other, not just philosophers, but novelists, poets, experimental writers. Why do we have to stick to this one genre? I'm curious more of what it's adding to the overall mix, or how it affects our atmosphere, our overall atmosphere, our cosmosphere.
Well, I think Aurobindo would be a great, I mean, we're all comparativists here. We like to compare, contrast and compare. And I think Aurobindo is really into the superhuman, the supramental. He's very much evolutionary kind of thinker, and which I think is very different from Sloterdijk, or what I'm picking up from Sloterdijk. So I think they would complement one another. I may be wrong, but I think that would be a good thing to follow up this way.
We might also find that Aurobindo and maybe even other integral thinkers are recapitulating the same metaphysics that Sloterdijk is already
tossed out. But he doesn't go into the East very much. And Aurobindo is basically, Hindu. Mm-hmm. But he was educated in the West, so he knows Latin and Greek. So I think he would be a very good contrast. Anyway, you may be right. I don't know, but I don't think he's.
Well, let's get through Globes first. Put some kind of schedule together for Globes, which I think I agree. John had brought this up in the forum too. I think we can do this in larger chunks. Oh. Maybe like. Monthly get together, but like 200 pages at a clip, yeah. And get it done in 5 sessions or so.
Yeah, and this seems more readable than the last one to me.
I'm enjoying it better. Yeah, really.
It's not
refreshing.
So
it's refreshingly, more to some kind of a point. He's kind of, and he seems to be sticking with it. Like he started off Bubbles though with a very lucid and explanation of where it was going to go, and then it just kind of like lost it. But
all over the place.
we'll see. So I'm still kind of on the fence, but he's growing on me. He's growing on me, I have to say.
You have any thoughts, Doug?
I just wanted to chime in. I'm in the same boat with you, Heather. I have no knowledge. I have no books in front of me of Sloterdijk, and I might keep it that way. I'm debating whether to go to the library and get the book or purchase a book. And
here's a little small one. This is Sloterdijk, The Art of Philosophy. Mm-hmm. This might be a good beginning. I haven't read it yet, but it's definitely something small.
I definitely like the idea of kind of sticking with where you guys are headed right now, where we are headed, and kind of go from there.
What do you think, Jeffrey?
Sloterdijk is a bit like swimming in mud, right? It's like you spend a lot of time working your arms, but you don't get very far, very fast.
I say speed bump, you say mud.
Well, it sounds like we're all kind of converging on this idea of maybe once monthly then.
Yeah, I think once a month is good.
And so we're here beginning of December. Perhaps we should schedule something the first Thursday, let's say, in January. That'll be, where are we? Could be the first or second Thursday, depending on what you all have planned.
So
the first Thursday is the 4th. And the second be the 11th. Would doing it the 4th be too soon after the holiday for anybody?
No,
it's okay. I'll be staying with friends, but I can do it from the friends' place as well as here. So,
okay.
Quick question, Marco. How do you communicate with us? Do you send email or is it a...
Well, I haven't done a great job, honestly. we're mainly in the forum. There's a Infinite Conversations. There's a channel or a category for spheres specifically. So for each event, typically, I post a topic with the time and the Zoom link there. And, I haven't been very consistent about emailing and social media, et cetera. I'm reducing my overall cognitive social load. And so trying to focus as much as possible on the matter at hand. So if you just check in there, you could also, I'll add you to the group, and then I think you should get notifications even by email.
Okay, sounds good. Posted.
Or I can, I'll tag you or I'll tag the group, and then you'll get a notification.
Okay.
And then we've also used that to follow up too, like on the individual talks, either leading up to or afterwards, to articulate thoughts that maybe we didn't bring in or build on thoughts that might have arisen during the course of a talk. And there too, it's a sort of different pace, I'd say, than say a Facebook group, or like it's, I don't know if it's slower necessarily. It's
pretty intense time.
It's a different time space, and also one that we're cultivating, I'd say, and that's part of the idea, is to cultivate a discursive space that is cumulative in a way that builds a body of thought and that can grow over time. Doug just now is picking up Gebser, and we have all those threads from the reading now, a couple of years ago almost, is it's going to be. So
I'd like to go through Gebser too.
You may have a dyad.
That's right.
Yeah, I'll
read him again.
I followed Doug's post this today. So I think that was great what you posted, Doug. So I'm interested. I'll go back and read it.
Yeah. I don't think I can read Gebser and Sloterdijk at the same time.
Well, it's in the archive, so it's always an option.
That's right. In a way, and part of the inspiration is also a kind of time-free space, the Gebserian dimension, kind of beyond the mental acceleration and hyper, intensification of moment to moment. Like, how can we let thoughts kind of unfold over more time? And part of that is also, in a way, creating an alternative to the social media sphere that, I've really had to distance myself from, because it was driving me crazy. And I have found my thoughts that's a whole nother conversation. I'd love to have it sometime. But I guess we're agreed then on next month, first Thursday. So I will post the recording of this. That's another thing. We record these, we post them so folks can watch them afterwards, and we could also reflect on our own process. And what we've also done is that each time, And this has been, I thought, useful. Somebody leads it off. So they will begin with a summary or a take or a question or what have you. And we've taken turns doing that. And that's been a way of structuring it and kind of circulating leadership around the group. So I kind of did that today. I could have probably done a better summary than I did. But I wasn't sure where we all were going to be at in the reading. So whatever. Would somebody like to volunteer to lead us off next time? We'll have to decide exactly what we read, but let's say up to chapters 2 or 3 or something like that. Anyone?
I'll go. I haven't done it before, so I guess it's my turn. Someone's got to do it.
I can't imagine myself coming up with something, but I wouldn't mind just maybe putting together something.
You want to do it, Doug? You can.
I might not even do the reading, so we'll see what happens. But yeah, I can take it up.
Okay, why don't you do it then, if you want to do
it. And see what happens from there, and then somebody have an actual backup who actually read the book. So.
Oh, I think you should read it if you're going to lead it.
I'm just messing.
Okay. But
so count me out. I'm sorry.
Okay, so you're not sure you're going to read it, so you shouldn't. So you're not going to lead
Correct.
It, or you're
Correct.
Just fucking with me.
I will not be the one to present.
Okay, so then John.
Okay, I'll read it and I'll present something very brief. Like that'd be fun.
Thank okay, you. And like it doesn't have to necessarily be a summary of the text. I mean, it's helpful to refer back to the text. I think it's important to refer back to the text and ground the conversation in what he actually said. But like I did when I started talking today, I referred to an anecdote, the sculpture that I saw in a park of a globe and what that made me think and feel, etc. I tried to anyway. We're very open, so. That's what the experimental spirit is, part of what we're trying to circulate in our atmosphere, if you will. Anyway, I think I'm out of steam. I think my bubble is deflated.
We can trust the group to help lead us through these things. So.
Yeah. If without the group, I don't think I would have read any of this, honestly. That's the other thing, is that when I know that a discussion is coming up, I'll read more carefully and take more notes and really try to form my perspectives that 99% I don't even get to bring them in. But the knowledge that we're going to be talking seems to focus attention. So that's useful.
Great.
Yeah. Are we good?
Thank you.
Any last words from anyone?
It's been a pleasure.
Happy holidays, everybody, and happy New Year.
Happy holidays. Thank you.
Take care.
Hey, we'll nice seeing you, Doug. Heather. Nice meeting you, Heather.
Great. Nice to meet you.
All right.
We'll see you all soon.
Bye.
Great to meet you people. So.